Now, last time we looked at the medieval tantric traditions and their origin and the development of the Shaiva Siddhanta, the dualistic Shaivism, and the Pratyabhijna, the monistic Shaivism, the non-dual Shaivism, and we looked at the non-Siddhantika traditions, and we looked at Abhinavagupta and summarize some of his ideas about the upayas, the methods, the ways of achieving enlightenment and liberation. And we looked at the non-means, the non-way, which links him with the monistic ontology, the monistic worldview. And we also looked at Abhinavagupta's later arguments against the Buddhists, if I remember. I think we did that in his Pratyabhijna Vimarshini. And his critique of the Buddhist notion of no self, and also his critique of the Vedanta. I think we touched briefly on that. So today we're moving into a sort of parallel tradition of Vaishnavism, of tantric Vaishnavism. So tantrism exists in Shaiva and Shakta traditions primordially and prototypically, but it also exists in the Vaishnava traditions as well. And the left-handed kind of tantra, that influences a group in Bengal called the Sahajiyas, which we're not going to look at. So likewise, as we have with the Shaivism, we get a similar pattern developing of Puranic worship of Shiva, Svarta worship of Shiva. So here you get texts like the Vishnu Purana, and the Bhagavata Purana, and a text from the Hari Vamsa. These are about Krishna, which is an appendix, if you like, to the Mahabharata. Now, the lineage of Hari, the lineage of the Lord, the Purana, the ancient texts about the Lord, Bhagavata, concerning the Bhagavan, the Lord. Now, that's a bit. If I draw a few, I have to draw this slightly differently, I think. Vishnu then has his origins, as we've looked, in the Veda, where he's fairly sort of lowly kind of deity, but he becomes to the fore in the later tradition. By the medieval period, he's a great deity. And he's articulated in the Vishnu, his worship is expressed in his textual Puranas. So let's call this orthodox worship of Vishnu. Brahmanical orthodox worship of Vishnu. The smarter Brahmins, those who follow the Smritis, but who also follow the Puranas, but who stick to Varnashrama Dharma, who are keen on maintaining Vedic orthodoxy and the boundaries around their ritual purity. There's another tradition which develops, because Vishnu is a composite deity, made up of lots of different deities over a period of time. And you've got another tradition. Krishna Gopala tradition. And this is Krishna as a young man who plays the flute, who dances with the gopis, who's a sensuous, cheeky kind of trickster type figure. And that tradition was from the area of Vrindavan, and that feeds in to mainstream Vaishnava tradition. So I suppose you've got three streams, perhaps. It might be a bit simplistic to say that, but you've got the Krishna Gopala tradition, you've got mainstream Vaishnava tradition from through the Puranas, and you've got also the worship of Narayana, the support of human beings, the support of men, the Lord, in the right back in the Brahmanas, And Narayana becomes identified with Vishnu. I mean, I can't remember the history of this identification, but you get Vishnu identified with Narayana and Narayana identified with Krishna. Another name for Krishna is Vasudeva. So it's a terribly complex story that I'm afraid I can't remember the details of, but you can read about, particularly in Bhandarkar's Vaishnavism, Shaivism, and minor religious cults or something like that. But it's a terribly complicated story. So you've got this development of Vaishnavism, by the 11th, this is say the early medieval period, perhaps a bit earlier. You've got a very important text. So I'm going to slightly complicate this further. To say you've actually got another group called the Bhagavatas. Who worship the Lord, Bhagavan. Now this group is, we looked at these last week. Their main text is of course the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. Let's put it in brackets. The Bhagavata tradition, whose main text is the Bhagavad Gita, which again links in to the Krishna Gopala tradition, who absorbed the Gita as their own text, and also into the Puranic tradition. So all these are kind of feeding into, say, by the time of the 11th century, you've got mainstream Vaishnavism, which divided into various sects, particularly, most important, the Sri Vaishnavas, whose main exponent is Ramanuja, as we've looked at. Madhva, call them Madhvas. The group who follow Madhva, the dualist, and you've got another thinker who's about the 15th century, Vallabhar, perhaps a bit earlier. Remember the
Chaitanya
Mahaprabhu? No, it's a different one.
Okay.
The Vallabhar.
Oh,
Vallabhacharyas. And then also, lastly, the fourth one, the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, Bengal or Northern, and this is a tradition that develops from Chaitanya, whose dates are
1497.
Then he died.
That's when he was born.
Okay. Sorry, I don't know. Born
1497.
So late 15th century, early 16th century. Late 15th century, early 16th century. The Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. And that carries on down to the present day. So Prabhupada was in that tradition. So quite a complex story. Now, linked in with the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition in Bengal is also another group. Is this terribly, have you got this so far, everyone? Is it okay? Maybe we need some radical simplification.
Got it about as simple as you can, haven't you?
It's terribly complex history, this. So you've got Puranic worship of these different deities. You've got that, Orthodox Puranic worship of the deities. Like, the Puranas are this body of medieval texts containing mythology, lineages of kings, a ritual, all sorts of cosmologies, all in these very rich and ornate, elaborate, overflowing texts. Composed by... by reciters who would go from village to village reciting these stories. And they get adopted and adapted by the smarter Brahmanical, orthodox, mainstream Vedic tradition, theistic tradition, who believe in the Puranas that you have the world egg and Vishnu's heaven is at the top. So when you die, if you're a devotee, you get reborn in Vishnu's heaven, the Vishnu Loka, Vaikuntha in the later tradition. or one of the hands. It gets very elaborate and ornate cosmology. You've got a local tradition called the Krishna, which has come to be known as the Krishna Gopala tradition in Vrindavan, which is a derivative of this dark god Krishna, who plays a flute, who is on the edges of normal orthodox kind of behaviour, who's naughty, who's kind of steals the cow god's clothes, who makes up to 16,000 of them at once and that kind of thing. And he's a trickster kind of figure, and that worship of him feeds into orthodoxy and becomes mainstream orthodox, gets absorbed into the smarter Brahmanical worship of Vishnu, Krishna Vishnu. And there's a group called the Bhagavatas. I've made a distinction between the Krishna Gopala tradition and the Bhagavata tradition, because the Bhagavata tradition, I think is different, because their main text is the Bhagavad Gita. And they're, of course, linked in very closely. I put them over there, but actually they're very linked in with the Puranic orthodox worship of Vishnu. But the word Vishnu only occurs in the Gita a couple of times, so it's really a Krishna, Karshna text. Yes. So the Bhagavad Gita feeds into all of this. So by the time you've got to the 11th century, you've got mainstream Vaishnavism, which has the Shru Vaishnavas, feeds in with Ramanuja, then later the Madhva tradition, then later the Vallabhacharyas, and also the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And all these absorb this Vaishnava, this very rich, thick Vaishnava tradition. Another group, I mentioned Narayana. Narayana is linked with a tradition called the Pancharatra, which is what I want to get to. And the Pancharatra becomes Tantric Vaishnavism. What is Tantric Vaishnavism? It's a Pancharatra. Now, there is another group in Bengal called the Sahajiyas, which is influenced by the Shakta side of Tantrism, the left-hand Tantrism, who practice ritual sex outside of caste boundaries and who drink in their rituals. And they're also related to the bowls of Bengal, the singing bowls you may have come across. You can buy their records still. And there's a great book, actually, it's very old now, but I still think it's a great book, by Dasgupta, S.N. Dasgupta, called Obscure Religious Cults, which is a wonderful name, but it's about the Sahajiyas. Obscure Religious Cults by Dasgupta. See through the title and get to the title's a bit sort of derogatory, but it's a very interesting book. And there's been work done since then by David Haberman, I think, might have done some work. Dimmock, the classic book to read on this is Dimmock, The Place of the Hidden Moon, by the Sahajiyas, Tantric, left hand Tantric Vaishnavism. So I go to draw a more simplified diagram. Bhagavata tradition, which has the Gita as its text. Smarta Brahmin worship of Vishnu. Krishna Gopala tradition. Sampradayas, the four traditions. mentioned earlier, which is Balabhar. Krishna Gopal, Chaitanya, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Sri Vaishnavism, and the other one, the Madhava tradition. And those traditions in turn are complex, you know, with subgroups and so on. So this is Vishnuism, and my reading of it. Oh, the main text of the Krishna Gopala tradition is the Bhagavata Purana. I don't want to restrict it to that, of course. I mean, it becomes pan-Hindu. I mean, it's the most popular Purana amongst in Hinduism. So I wouldn't want to restrict it to that tradition, but its origins are in that kind of Krishna Gopala tradition. And it gets linked in with the Vishnu Purana and gets absorbed into the smarter Brahmanical worship of Vishnu. So the three main texts of the Vaishnavas are the Vishnu Purana, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Bhagavata Purana. Now the Pancharatra, the one I want to talk about, has its origins way back in the Vedas, in one of the Brahmanas, the Shatapatha Brahmana, the 100th path Brahmana, where five nights is mentioned, the word Pancharatra is mentioned, and it refers to five nights sacrifice, a yajna which lasts for five nights, and that's just an obscure reference to this group. Also, there's a section in the Mahabharata that refers to worship of Narayana, and it mentions a Pancharatra in connection with worship of Narayana, this god Narayana, who gets identified with Vishnu. But by the medieval period, the 7th, 8th century, you have these texts called the Tantras, and you get Tantric Vaishnavism, the Tantric version of the Pancharatra. Now, the relation between the Tantric Pancharatra, what we know of the Pancharatra now, and the earlier tradition, isn't precisely clear, but it's probably something like early Buddhism to Tibetan Buddhism, something like that. So the teachings of the Tibetan Buddhism are hardly recognisable, arguably, in the Pali material, Pali texts. So likewise, the teachings of the Pancharatra Tantras are hardly recognisable in the earlier kind of tradition. But there's some continuity. There's a reinvention of the tradition in the light of the Tantric revelation. And that Pancharatra also feeds into mainstream Vaishnavism and the Sampradayas. So in the Sri Vaishnava sect, which I mentioned, there was a teacher called Yamana. Yamanacharya.
Yeah.
He wrote a book defending the Pancharatra revelation, because there's obviously been criticism of it. Oh, that's not Vaidika, that's tantric, and that's outside the pale of, that's not real revelation. But Yamana wrote a book defending the Pancharatra revelation. He's a mainstream Sri Vaishnava thinker, and he's the grand teacher of Ramanuja. So Ramanuja accepts the Pancharatra as revelation. It's pretty interesting. But he hardly ever refers to the Pancharatra. Ramanuja is clearly in the Vedanta tradition, although he technically accepts the revelation of the Pancharatra, he doesn't refer to it. But he would nevertheless adhere to the Pancharatra rituals, which became the norm of the Sri Vaishnava tradition. Also need to say that in the Pancharatra Tantras, you don't get any of the kind of the left-hand tantric material that you get in the Shaiva traditions. And the Pancharatra is keen to differentiate itself from the Shaiva revelation, as that's a demonic revelation, that we have the true, pure revelation. There's also one other tradition related, very strongly related to the smarter worship of Vishnu, called the Vaikarnasa. And that's often linked to the Pancharatra. But and they're still very strong. They're a highly orthodox group in South India. But they like to differentiate themselves from the Pancharatra, who they regard as a lower kind of status. and they have their own texts, but I think their ritual is slightly different. They don't accept they don't adopt all the Pancharatra rituals, but they're very close in many ways to them. Gerard Kohler is very good at all of this. And if you want to see a summary of these traditions, he's got an excellent article in that Blackmore Companion to Hinduism, where he outlines this whole kind of picture fairly clearly. It's probably drawn slightly different to the way I've drawn it, but it's very good on all of these traditions.
So the online one, is it?
Is it? It could be online.
The Blackwell one.
Blackwell, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's online.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
The one you edited?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's online.
Online, isn't it?
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Is it free?
Yeah. No, it's really good.
Your commission's just gone.
That is really good.
It's holidays, thank you.
It's got some quite detailed articles in there.
Has it? Oh,
Yeah.
It's a great book. It's got some really good articles in there, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's really good. And Stahl's article is particularly drawing your attention to. Stahl and Science. But, I mean, Kohler is brilliant. And Rich Freeman's articles are really good too, very original. So I was pleased that they did that. Okay, the Pancharatra then have got their tantras, and they call their tantras, not tantras, just a confusing thing, Sanghitas collections. So that's a terribly complex picture, but I hope it's a bit simplified there.
Whereabouts do you place the sun tradition?
The Sants are.
This is pretty much juxtaposed next to these ones, isn't it?
Yeah.
It absorbs a lot of the elements and then transfers them, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The Sant tradition, these are all, there's a distinction between Sadguna and Nirguna worship of God. So Sadguna means with qualities. You worship God with qualities, like Krishna with a flute of blue, and has various qualities of parental love. Those kinds of things. And Nirguna is you worship a god without qualities, it's wholly transcendent, and you can't say anything about. And the worship of this Nirguna deity also developed in North India, in Maharashtra, and in the Punjab, where it was closely related to the Vaishnava tradition, to the worship of Krishna, but also worship of Vishnu. So the Sant tradition. We put it just outside of the Vaishnava tradition, but it's closely related to the who's the Kandarpur deity? Who's the Kandarpur? Vitoba. Worship of Vitoba. It's related to that tradition. So the saint, which it means saint, but it's not related to our word saint. It just means it's from a Sanskrit sat good. Worship. God without qualities, Nirguna deity, but it's also Bhakti. All of these traditions are Bhakti traditions. And then you get this Bhakti tradition of the Sants, which links into Sikhism as well. Sikhism is a Sant tradition, is a reification, if you like, of a Sant tradition with Guru Nanak. But Kabir and all of these people, Namdev, Tukaram,
Redas Dadu,
Mirabai Dadu.
Yes. Meera also would be a part of that? Meera?
Yeah, Mirabai, yeah. Raidas, all these poets who wrote this beautiful poetry in vernacular languages to a god without qualities. Probably influenced by Sufism as well. And indeed, the Adi Granth, the Sikh canon, contains material from the Sufis, Farid, I can't remember. But yeah, the Sant tradition is also linked into on the edges of this Vaishnava tradition. And Radhaswami, look at the word Radhaswami, the Lord of Radha, Radhaswami tradition. Sant tradition in the Punjab, very good tradition. Radhaswami worships Nirguna deity through the Guru, through the Master, the Sat Guru, who is embodiment of the Lord. And like the Krishna Gopala tradition, there's an emphasis on mantra, on sound. In all of these traditions, sound is terribly important. Nada, Shabad. Shabda, from Shabda, Shabad. Naam, the name of God. So you repeat the name of God in order to get into contact with God, to change your consciousness to the vibrational frequency of the Lord, if you like. And there's also an emphasis in the Sam tradition on God as sound, manifest as sound, as inner sound. So you practice your devotional meditation, worshipping the master, visualize the guru's face, and you listen and hear the inner sound of the Lord through blocking off your senses. So you sometimes see yogis, Shankara, with a tea stick, a danda, that they're resting on. And that's the stick that they lean their elbows on, block off their I can't do it. I used to be able to do it. Block off their senses. So you can just about breathe. To hear the inner sound after having repeated your mantra for 2.5 hours or something, you know, block off your senses to hear the inner mantra, the inner sound. Resting in your tea stuff. So all that yogic kind of inner sound tradition is also part of this picture. Now the returning then to the Pancharatra, sorry, that was a slight diversion. You've got the sources of the Pancharatra, then these three texts. The Pashkara, Satvata and Jayakya. There's also a text called the Ahira Budhniya Samhita, and also the Lakshmi Tantra. The Lakshmi Tantra has been translated by Sanjukta Gupta. We got a few copies of that in the library. And a lot of the Lakshmi is actually based on the Jayakya, which is its model. And the Ahira Budhniya Samhita, the serpent from the depth, is again an important text. And there's a fellow called Otto Schrader, who wrote a book called The Introduction to the Pancharatra in 1915 in prison in Madras, I think.
Sorry, what's the name?
Introduction to Pancharatra by Otto Schrader. And that's an excellent introduction to this tradition. It still is. It stood the test of time. And that's mainly based on the Ahira Budhniya Samhita. But he explains the ritual and he explains the cosmology particularly well. Now there's a problem with the relation of these texts, that they claim to be revelation. And indeed, Yalmana defended these texts as revelation, but they seem to have an ambiguous status in mainstream Vaishnava tradition. Although in the south, the Pancharatra tradition, it is still strong, and indeed, the Sri Vaishnava tradition is Pancharatra in a way, in its ritual practices, it's Pancharatra. And there's the Ayars in South India, they follow the Pancharatra. But it's interesting that there's no commentary on the text. As you had a very rich Shaiva tradition of Tantric Shaivism with all these dualist Agamas and non-dualist Tantras. And there's lots of commentaries on them. The Shaiva Siddhanta comment on their texts. But the Vaishnava tradition doesn't seem to comment on the Pancharatra texts. So there's no commentary. They comment on the Vedanta tradition, but there's no commentaries, philosophical commentaries on any of these Pancharatra texts. And that's interesting. That's an interesting question. Why is there no commentary? Why are there no commentaries on these traditions? One is they could have been lost, but it's doubtful. It could be that the intellectual energy of the tradition is going elsewhere, namely into the Vedanta. And that these texts function largely in the later traditions as ritual manuals. But even then, you have, certainly in the Shaiva tradition, you have philosophical commentary. But anyway, there's a gap there. Now, the doctrines of these texts, the Pancharatra doctrines, are the doctrine of emanations, principally emanations, the vyuhas, in which the Lord, the pure Lord Vasudeva, Vishnu, emanates in different forms, and they divide the creation. There's a hierarchical cosmology, and there's a pure creation, Shuddha Sarga, and an impure creation. And in the pure creation is the manifestation of the Lord in these four forms. As Vasudeva, who emanates Sankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. Now in mythology, all of these are relatives of Krishna. They're all relatives of Krishna, like his grandson, like his... I can't remember who they are, actually. Help me out.
Grandchildren.
You Vaishnava wallers, help me out on this. Can you remember the... Anyway, you can look them up. I can't even remember my own relatives, so I can't remember Krishna's relatives. So I don't know what relation they are to each other. You'll have to check them out. Second cousin twice removed or something, you know. So anyway, they've taken mythology and they've cosmologized it. They've taken these mythological, it could have been historical figures, who knows, but and they've mythologized them. Cosmologized them. So they're emanations. And in the Jayakya Samhita, they become Bhagavan, Achyuta, Satya, and Purusha, completely different names. And those deities are deities in the Vaikarnasa tradition. So the Lord emanates Achyuta, and the text says, as a bolt of lightning comes out of a cloud, so Achyuta comes out of the Lord. And there's another image, Satya emerges out of Achyuta, as a bubble emerges out from, rises up from the ocean, so Satya rises up from Achyuta. And Purusha exists as not only in the pure creation but as the inner controller in your heart, the Antaryamin, the inner controller. So God is present in you as the Purusha. So it's interesting, the word Purusha there, which is of course the Samkhya word for the soul or the self, functions to mean your inner essence, which is also the essence of God. Vasudeva, the Lord, appears in you as the inner controller who is Purusha. Now, the word Purusha also functions in a cosmological sense in the Jayakya Samhita. I think, and also in the Ahayavudhanya Samhita, to refer to a certain level of the cosmos. So you've got the pure creation up here, which is vast, and then the I think one of the images is that the lower creation is like a hair floating on the ocean of this other bigger creation beyond it. And then you get the impure creation. So you've got the viewhas, the emanations. There's an interesting term, viewha. It's from something to spread out. It could be linked to Buddhism because you get the Sukhavati viewha, the Buddhist text, Mahayana Buddhist text, about devotional kind of text. So then you get impure creation, and here you've got Maya. And you've got the Purusha. Now Maya generates the lower cosmos, Prakriti, and so on, down to the earth. So you've got the Samkhya Tattvas, all the rest of it, but you've also got this complex Vaishnava mythology. So what's the Purusha here? The Purusha gets reinterpreted in these Pancharatra texts to mean a collective... receptacle for souls. When the contraction of the universe emanates out and contracts back in on itself every few million years, and when the universe contracts back in, all the souls come to rest in Purusha. It's called the beehive of the souls, the beehive. Ali Kosha, I can't remember the precise term. And when the Lord acts upon the lower creation again, this is never completely destroyed. All the souls get thrown out into the universe again, like bees, reincarnated over and over again. And at liberation, they don't go back there. They go to Vishnu's heaven. It's probably mapped onto this system, but I'm afraid I don't know precisely how it's mapped onto that system. So, and liberation then is, what's liberation? Liberation in this tradition is still dualistic because it maintains a distinction between the self and God. but it talks about merging, the merging of the self with the Lord. And Ramanuja theologically gets around this problem by saying that the you can merge with the Lord in his vibhuti, in his powers, but not in his essence. His svarupa is always beyond. So there's never a complete identification of the self with God. There's always a difference, some difference. Now the practice of the Pancharatra is through initiation, diksha, like the Shaiva rites, only with Vaishnava deities, and the ritual. And so the Jayakya Samhita is the locus classicus, really, of the identification of the body with the cosmos. And you get these daily rites of, they describe the daily rites of bathing, the Bhuta Shuddhi, the purification of the body. So you repeat mantras and destroy the body in your imagination, from the sole of the feet to the crown of the head. So in the Jayakya it describes you imagine a mantra pervading from the soles of the feet to the knees, and knees to the thighs, thighs to the navel, navel to the heart, heart to the throat, I think, throat to the crown of the head, and you symbolically destroy the body up in your imagination. And the body is then burned by a fire which burns up, and is, your body is a pile of ashes in your visualization, which is then washed away by a flood of mantras. And then you then create a divine body through nyasa, through touching parts of the body with mantra. And because only a god can worship a god in the tantric tradition. And that's followed by inner worship, where you visualize the deity, mental worship, you visualize Narayana. You visualize him above your head, Narayana, forearm form of Narayana. You bring him down into your heart through the crown of your head, and you worship him in your heart, in your imagination, offering him flowers, incense, food. And then you take him back out, and he goes back up there. And then you open your eyes and you perform external worship to a concrete icon, to a concrete image of the Lord. And you perform yajna, a fire ritual as well. So there's what you do, you construct a divine body, a divya deha, or a divya sharira, to worship the Lord. So there's a close connection in this tradition between yoga and ritual. I mean, what's those elaborate visualizations are very sort of linked to yoga, they're very meditative. It's not purely external ritual, it's the external and the internal are completely integrated. And they say that the Lakshmi Tantra says that you perform external and internal worship to get rid of different kinds of karma. Karma done with the mind and karma done with the body. But ultimately, it's not your efforts that liberates you, it's the grace of the Lord. The prasada, the grace of the Lord, who liberates you. And it's a bit like it's a bit sort of the cat monkey thing we had. It's a bit monkey like, I guess, this tradition. It could be that there are two ways of describing the same process. And what's interesting is perhaps in these and other traditions is that it's the text, is terrible, the revelation is inscribed on the body through mantras being identified, through being imposed on the body, and through the visualization process. And so those elaborate rituals are still carried on to some extent today.
Can I ask you a quick question about a formula? You mentioned the crown of the head to the soles of the feet. Is that a fixed formula, or is it your descriptive language?
My descriptive language.
The Dagger, they say it's a fixed formula because I've seen people do this kind of puja.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it is, I think.
Oh, it's a fixed formula, but I can't remember reading from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet, but not just that phrase. But yeah, it is from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet.
Yeah, they started I've seen them touch.
You've seen them do it. Yeah.
When they pray, actually.
Yeah, the Shaivas do the same. It's the same process. So what is tantric yoga, if you like it? You could say that it's actually. Process that's described in the Jayakya Samhita cuts across all the tantric traditions. Yeah, so there's Bruno Lachaud is good on this, on the Scheibe version of this. But there's not much written on the Vaishnava tradition, really. So that's the terribly complicated kind of tradition of the Vaishnava, historically tradition. It's terribly complicated, I think. Is this a Scheibe one, I suppose? But so that's the doctrine and the practice of the Pancharatra then. So that lastly, then, there are common themes in Indic, so what we might call Indic soteriologies, which we've looked at: freedom from, freedom to, and freedom by. And there are different conceptions of what liberation is according to your theist, whether you're a theist or whether you're a monist, really, or whether you're an atheist even. But freedom from, they seem to share a common view that it's freedom from the cycle of rebirth and suffering. And that's a fairly common view. The soul is liberated from the veil of tears, from the cycle of birth and death. Well, freedom too, it depends upon your tradition. So, for, of course, for Shankara, it's a realization of your identity with the Absolute. For Ramanuja, it's a liberation through grace. And realizing your partial identity with the Lord, your identity with his energies, but not with his essence, with his power. For the Shaivas, it's Shaiva Siddhanta, it's equality with Shiva, Shiva Tulya, you become like Shiva, but not merged with Shiva. So you become a Shiva. But for the monistic Shaivas, you recognize your identity with Shiva. Your identity with pure consciousness. So freedom too varies in these different traditions quite radically. And freedom by, again, it's linked with freedom too. Freedom by effort or freedom by grace. If you have a theistic tradition, then your freedom is by grace or effort, depending on which tradition you're in. There's a variation in that. Surrender, prapati is in Lakshmi Tantra. There's a chapter on prapati, which is surrender to the Lord, which is being open to the Lord's grace. And also within these Indian soteriologies, you've got certain fundamental concepts, like you've got cosmologies, the tattvas, which we've got from Samkhya, which gets elaborated in the medieval period, particularly in the Tantric Tantras. You've got the centrality of the body in terms of practice. You focus the body as your method of your sadhana, the means by which you achieve liberation, a somatic exploration, really. And you've got the idea of transcendence, the transcendence of the body through the body. And other common themes of theism, atheism, and non-dualism. So some Indian soteriologies are atheistic, like Bowders and the Jains, and some are non-dualistic that we've looked at, Shankara and Pratyabhijna. And you've also got fundamental practices such as yoga, bhakti, and grace, which isn't a practice, but is a very present kind of theme. So those common themes are supposed to be sort of simplifications, which allows you to kind of look through this complex history.